Weeknights from 6 on 2FM.
Thanks to the two Johnnies, it's Wednesday, September 20th, and this is Game On. While there's live Rugby World Cup action and Champions League action already underway, Keane Tracy and Paul Corrie are with us. Plus, Damien Lawler with all the Gaelic Games news and Anna-Maria McCleary on completing the Barclay Fall Classic. If you want to get in touch, text us on 51552 or tweet at GameOn2FM.
Game On on 2FM.
Now, welcome along. Paul Corrie is with me in studio. There is live Champions League action already, which is great. We love it on midweek evening as the nights are getting dark. It is Galatasaray against FC Copenhagen, 16 minutes gone, no score there. And Real Madrid and Union Berlin, 16 minutes gone there as well, and no score. How are Real Madrid looking, Paul?
Yeah, they're playing quite well, Murray. Union Berlin are well in the game. They've had one or two chances themselves, but Madrid controlling the majority of the possession, as you would expect. But it's a different look and feel this year with Real, you know, no Benzema at the top end of the pitch, mm-hmm. which we're so used to seeing. Vinicius Junior's out injured, and they've got Hossolu, who's ex-Newcastle and didn't do very well at Newcastle, leading the line. But Jude Bellingham looking a star already in that white kit.
Yeah, like there's been a lot of talk about how he's settling in and how he's settling in so well, Paul, which is pretty amazing when you think of the caliber of player that are there, the tradition, the pressure, and he's just slotting in.
Yeah, I mean, given the fact that he's 20 years of age, and oh, he has a lot of experience already playing in the Champions League and obviously at the top end of Europe with Borussia Dortmund. But it's the goals that he scored and the importance of the goals, Marie, to win games late on in particular, that has gotten them over the line against Getafe, Celta Vigo and against Almeria. So yeah, he's contributing to the side already. It was always going to be interesting how he would fit in with the likes of Tuameni, Camavinga, Modric. Toni Kroos is still there as well, and where they would find that balance. He seems to be playing very high up the pitch and off the front man, which probably suits him. And already you can see, even in the first 18 minutes of this game, how pivotal he is in building up the play, but also then joining in the final third. So wouldn't be expected, or wouldn't be surprised if he was to kind of get himself on the score sheet again with how advanced he is playing. But already, you know, slotting into a Real Madrid team, and he looks at home playing
worth
there.
Every penny of that big price tag.
Absolutely, and they were probably quite wise in how they did that deal. They seemed to get that deal done quite early in the summer before the transfer fees really started to go bananas with, I don't know if it was
and
Saudi
before the Saudi Pro League really took off.
Yeah so he seemed to want to go there. It seems like the right move, but it's, for me, it's a Real Madrid team that are in somewhat of a transition. Like Militao's out injured as well, Courtois is out for the season, so it doesn't have the same feel of the team who went on that, you know, fantastic run of winning Champions Leagues. Players have come to their natural end. Ronaldo's obviously moved on, Modric is a couple of years older, as is Toni Kroos. Can Tuameni and Camavinga and Bellingham really take a hold of that Real Madrid team and push them on? I'm not so sure. I think they're a level below Man City, but will certainly be a team that you would expect to see in the last eight or the last four of the competition.
Okay, well, we'll be keeping an eye on that game throughout the programme. I did mention as well that there's Rugby World Cup action already underway. Italy and Uruguay, with Uruguay leading 17-14. They were leading 17-7 at half time and looked like they could have been on track for an upset, but it looks like Italy are making their way back into that game as well. So I will keep you updated on that. We're going to turn our attention now to the Ireland rugby team. Tomorrow we're expecting a squad announcement, but there has been a lot of talk about South Africa's seven forwards and whether or not Ireland are going to mirror that. Well, Simon Easterby, Ireland's defence coach, admitted that Ireland are not planning to have seven forwards on the replacement bench. He was speaking to the media today. Let's hear from him.
I think every team has a particular strategy. It's and it's up to them to believe that that strategy is the right thing for each game, you know, and obviously they believe that is the way that they need to set themselves out to beat us on Saturday, just like we'll be planning the way that we want to beat South Africa. So listen, it's a talking point. I don't think it changes anything for us, to be honest, and it's something for you guys to have a little bit of discussion over. What will determine it at the end, it will just be hindsight will allow everyone to say it was the right or the wrong thing to do, and you know, like I say, it's their strategy, and it's not something that we can control. But yeah, I'd say we'll be fairly conventional, I think, in what we do on the weekend in terms of the split. But yeah, like I say, it's not something that we've taken a huge amount of time looking at. It's a talking point, but it's, at the end of the day, it's it's their decision to go with that, and it's their strategy. Ours will be slightly different. Yeah, everyone trained really well today, to be honest. Probably Jack's the only one that's slightly behind in terms of being able to get himself right for this weekend. And, you know, he's done incredibly well, as have the medics, conditioners, to get him up to speed. And he's actually probably on track from where we thought he'd be. So, you know, he's done really well, happy with his progress. Finlay and Dan both trained really well today. So, you know, they're back in the mix. Coming into this game, I think everyone knows that this game was always going to be sort of the big game that we had in the first three rounds. You know, we built up nicely through Romania and Tonga. You know, we've got some ironed out a few things in our attack. Same defensively, we were tested way more against Tonga. So I think we always knew that this was going to be the pivotal game leading up to Scotland the week after, so the 2 weeks after. So, yeah, it's we're just going about our business at the moment. You guys are writing, or press and media and supporters in particular, are speculating about what they might bring. We obviously are really confident and trust in what we've been doing, not just recently, but in the last year and a half, 2 years, and this is what we've been building towards. So hopefully we'll see plenty of that on Saturday as well. I think we know that when we play well and we play a certain way, that we're going to be difficult to play against and difficult to beat. So, you know, we'll be looking to implement a lot of the stuff that you'll have seen over the last couple of years in what we do on Saturday, as we have tried to do in the Tonga and the Romania games. So I think we haven't had to win ugly, as you call it, maybe too many times. I thought what we did in Samoa, against Samoa in Bayonne, was, I guess, another way of winning a game when the conditions weren't suited to playing with width and too much ball in hand. We found a way to win through our forward pack dominating in the latter stages of the game. And I think you're going to have to do that at certain times in every game. So, yeah, listen, it'll be great if we could throw the ball around and we'd score plenty of tries, but we know that we have to do things in the moment and make sure that we're adaptable. And that might mean playing certain ways in certain parts of the game.
So that was Ireland defence coach Simon Easterby speaking to the media as the build-up to the big South Africa game on Saturday continues. I'm delighted to say that Cian Tracy of the Irish Independent joins us now on the line. How are you, Cian?
Good, Marie. How are you?
Are you one of the lucky ones that's going to be there watching on Saturday night?
I am indeed. I've been over in France for the last, well, it feels like weeks, but it's only been three.
Wow.
Currently in tour where Ireland are based. They'll leave and they'll go to Paris in the morning and then they'll come back on Sunday, but obviously they have the week off, which probably couldn't fall at a better time really, when mm-hmm. you consider the attritional rate that we're probably going to be expecting from the South Africa game on Saturday.
Yeah, that's quite a stint to talk about you for a second. That's a long time. You're going to be there, well, all going to plan, you're going to be there for quite some time.
Yes, well, all going to plan, it'll be here till the start of November, really. okay. And that's certainly the way the Ireland players are talking about.
Yeah.
No one is talking about that they're coming home anytime soon. I think it's part of the whole mentality that's been shifted in Irish rugby, I think, over the last while. Someone like Gary Keegan coming in, I mean, there's no, you know, you don't go into a tournament like the World Cup not aiming to win it. But Irish teams, I think, in the past have shied away from it. Obviously, the history would suggest that it is a very difficult task. But like, having been on the ground here following them for the last few weeks, it's difficult to get away from the sense that even going into the game this weekend, an Irish team has never been better placed to go where no Irish team has gone before.
So past the quarterfinals.
I mean, it goes without saying that this game is absolutely huge on Saturday, but it also has, like, it's not a knockout game, but it feels like it is. But if Ireland were to beat the world champions, they would almost certainly avoid playing France in the quarterfinal in Paris. Look, my sense is that whoever wins the World Cup is going to have to beat France in Paris either way, but obviously you'd like to leave that until as late as possible. So the ramifications of beating the world champions is huge enough in itself, but if it meant that you avoided playing the hosts in front of what would largely be 80,000 French people, I think that would be a huge bonus as well. So it could really open up for Ireland. And like I said, you look at the injury toll, or the lack of injury toll, really, the players that could potentially come back this weekend. You heard Simon Easterby talking there about the conditioning of the players, and I think that's been something that's been really noticeable. Obviously, in their first game against Romania, they played in, the conditions were absolutely brutal, so hot. the lack of injuries, I think, coming from the games. Obviously, there's a huge amount of luck in that as well. But when you've a 38-year-old Johnny Sexton coming back without having played a game in 6 months and still looking like the best 10 in the world, I think you're in a pretty good place.
Absolutely. We're going to talk about South Africa in just a minute, but let's just quickly look ahead to the Ireland selection. What time tomorrow is there going to be a team announcement?
I think it's going to be roughly 2 p.m. Irish time, all going well. Like I said, Ireland are going to be getting on the TGV first thing in the morning, making their way to Paris. I believe they're actually based way outside the city centre, as are most teams, actually. So they'll be far away from whatever action is going on from the supporters, which there's talk of there could be 30,000 Irish supporters over in Paris this weekend. So Ireland will be hidden away from it, which is probably no bad thing either, but around 2 p.m. tomorrow Irish time is when we're expecting Andy Farrell to reveal his selection.
So you would have to think that the majority of his match day 23 are locked in. Are there a few places up for grabs in the starting 15 and on that bench?
Yeah, I think there are. I think you largely, I mean, the team, because there are so few injuries, like I said, is going to be along expected lines, I suppose. You know, Ireland basically ruled Jack Conan out for this weekend, and it seems like he's the only one of the 33-man squad who's not fit and available, which goes back to my early point. It's remarkable, really. So I guess it depends how fit Dan Sheehan is. Do Ireland feel the need to rush him back? Do they start him? Do they put him on the bench? Personally, my sense from being over here is that Ronan Kelleher will probably start. He played really well last weekend. The line-out was much more assured against Tonga, and he looked like the powerful ball carrier that he is. He's had such a tough time with injury over the last while, so that was a huge boost. I think it'll be interesting to see, like you heard Simon Easterby there saying that Ireland aren't going to go with a 6-2 split on the bench, but there's other ways of, I think, counteracting the inevitable onslaught that South Africa are going to bring. And I think the makeup of the back five is going to be interesting. I mean, they have so many options in the back row even alone, but could we see something like Tadhg Byrne moving to six from the second row, Peter O'Mahony at seven with Caelan Doris at number eight? Now, that sounds mad because you obviously know Josh van der Fleer there, who's the World Player of the Year. But I don't know, I wouldn't be surprised if Ireland looked to bring van der Fleer off the bench, the energy that he'll bring, because we know that the bench is going to have a huge role to play with what South Africa are going to bring. So if that was to come to pass, so someone like Joe McCarthy maybe get a start alongside James Ryan in the second row. He's 120 kg. He's a big brute of a man. He's only 22 years old, but the Irish coaches have been really, really impressed with him. And when you think about the power of that Springbok pack, someone like Joe McCarthy could have a role to play. And also then you have someone like Ian Henderson, who obviously has a huge amount of experience and is a big game player.
The Van der Fleer one is really interesting. Is that because there's an onus or there's a need for somebody to come off the bench, or is there question marks over him starting against South Africa?
No, I don't think it is. I think you're right, Marie. I think now more than ever in rugby, and it's a bit of a cliche, but it is a 23-player game. I mean, like the Springboks are proof of that, because like so much has been made of the fact that they're going with a 7-1 split. And like I think that's actually a compliment to Ireland. I mean, Jack Nienaber, the South Africa head coach, was speaking yesterday about how they did it against New Zealand a few weeks ago in the warm-up game, when they absolutely hammered the All Blacks at Twickenham, and they brought all seven forwards on at the same time, and it was just an incredible show of power and strength. But the fact that they ended up in that situation was only because of a late injury. So the Springboks, that Ian Arbour had said yesterday, have put the 7-1 in place with Ireland in mind. Now, you can look at that two ways, but if I was in Andy Farrell's shoes, I would take that as a compliment. Like, it's just loaded with risk. If they do get injuries to the back line, if they do have an injury to Bongi and Benambi, their hooker, they are going to be in a tight spot. But you look at what Van der Fleer can bring in terms of his energy. If you do go with Tadhg Byrne, Peter O'Mahony and Caelan Doris, you're littered with jackal threats in terms of the turnover, so the breakdown is going to be absolutely crucial. So it's one to watch out for. There's nothing to say obviously that Josh van der Fleer won't start. Obviously, like I said, he's World Player of the Year, but if you're looking for a bit of energy around that 50-55 minute mark when the Springboksers start unload their bench, then a guy like Josh van der Fleer, I think, is possibly a better option than someone like Peter O'Mahony, who I think's line-out prowess will be really important as well.
Do you think there's any way that South Africa will get caught out by their 7-1 bench split?
Oh yeah, there's a massive chance that it backfires. They've said that themselves as well. Look, the fact that South Africa didn't call up a replacement hooker for Malcolm Marks, they called up an out half in Andre Pollard, just speaks volumes to how much, I guess, they're happy to put square pegs in round holes. Like, I mean, the guy who they have covering hooker on Saturday, Dion Fiore, is a back row. So, like I said, if Bongi and Mbanambi goes down injured, you're going to end up with a guy who, okay, he's been training and scrummaging at hooker, but going up against like the number one ranked team in the world is a very different story. So, a similar story in the back line. They only have one back covering now. I know someone like Quagga Smith is a back row, but he used to play sevens for South Africa. So, look, he can fill in, but you're talking about, again, like I said, putting square pegs in round holes. So, I think Ireland will be absolutely trying to get their big ball carriers after, like someone like Manny Lebok, the South Africa out half, because if he was to go down injured, you're going to have a major reshuffle. I think you'd probably see someone like Faf de Klerk, South Africa scrum half, moving to 10. And like, that's far from ideal. But look, Jack Nienaber and Rassie Erasmus are two of the smartest head coaches in the game. Like, who are we to kind of, you know, question their logic? But I think they know themselves as well that if it pays off, it could be spectacular, but if it backfires, then they could look a bit silly.
I've heard a lot of people talking about the Bundee Aki Damian Delande battle. What one are you looking forward to most?
Yeah, that's certainly tasty. I think Bundee Aki has probably gone to a new level over the last few weeks. It's like, you think of Robbie Henshaw possibly coming off the bench on Saturday. I mean, he would walk into most teams, first choice teams in the tournament, so it's remarkable to think that Ireland are in such a strong position that someone like Henshaw doesn't get in. But Aki fully deserves his place. I mentioned the conditioning of the players earlier, and I think Aki probably typifies that more than most. He actually like looks faster than ever. I mean, we kind of associate Bundee Aki with real power game, nice subtle hands at the line, but you saw for his try last week the pace he has, he looks faster than ever, which is remarkable really. So I think that's a testament to him, but also the work that the conditioning coaches have done. So they know each other from obviously when Damian Delande played for Munster, Bundee Aki would have gone up against him with Connacht, so they'll know each other inside out. And that's probably a bit of a theme actually of this match, the amount of Irish, I mean, interest, I suppose you'd say. You've guys like Felix Jones, Rassie Erasmus, Jack Nienaber and the coaching staff. You've Orgie Snyman, John Klein, Dwayne Vermeulen, Stephen Kitchoff, who's coming to Ulster. So there's a huge amount of familiarity between the two teams. And that's before you even mentioned the fact that the South African URC teams have obviously joined the competition in the last couple of years. So I think that kind of lessens the fear factor as well. You think back to Munster winning the URC in Cape Town against the Stormers last season. So I think that will stand hard into.
Just a word as well on Ian Madigan. Cian, he announced his retirement from professional rugby, 34 years of age, 250 games for club and country. A great player, but was probably unlucky that his career coincided with two of the great out-halves that we've ever had in Ron Nogara and Johnny Sexton.
Yeah, absolutely. You hit the nail on the head there, Marie. I mean, I just mentioned it earlier. Johnny Sexton is 38 and for me, still the best out-half in the world. And yeah, look, Ian Madigan had a brilliant career. And the one thing I think I admire about him the most is that he stuck around Leinster for ages and did battle it out with Johnny Sexton. And to be fair, probably pushed Johnny Sexton on to another level in the earlier part of his career. But a lot of guys get, you know, happy enough to pick up the paycheck at the end of the week, even if they're not first choice. But Ian Madigan showed plenty of ambition. He went off to Bordeaux. That didn't quite work out, but a great move for him nonetheless in terms of a life experience. And then he went to Bristol as well before he finished up in Ulster. So I have huge admiration for guys like that who just aren't happy to play second fiddle. And to be fair, I mean, you think back, I mean, I think most listeners, the first image that would pop into their head when they think of Ian Madigan is his tears after the France game at the 2015 World Cup, when he was unbelievable in that game when Johnny Sexton was injured, and then he started in the quarterfinal defeat to Argentina. So I think he's a guy who made the most of his talent, and like you said, Marie, probably just unlucky to be around that the greatest out half that probably the country has ever produced in Johnny Sexton.
I said at the top of the programme that Uruguay could be on track for a shock, but Italy have really turned it around. It's 35-17 now. You've been talking to me for the last few minutes, so you probably didn't get to see any of it. But
I have actually an eye on it. I'm multi-talented, Marie.
Are you now? Yeah, so Italy look like they're going to get that win there, all right. But a good first half display from Uruguay, if you saw any of it.
Yeah, no, they were excellent. They've been playing brilliant rugby. I think they got a block down try there and they conceded a yellow card, but they had Italy rattled in the first half. And I think, unfortunately, it's a bit of it, like, this kind of sums up the World Cup, really, when a lot of the tier two nations have really impressed, but when it kind of comes down to it, I think the fitness and the conditioning of the likes of Italy, you saw it with Wales the other day against Portugal, just about snuck over the line. So look, I think that's just the reality of the gap that exists between tier one and tier two. But having a team like Uruguay, having a team like Chile, you know, the more kind of South American teams, the more you can kind of spread it around, the better, even if they are going to have to endure, I think, some tough days. And hopefully the score doesn't rack up too much more than it is now.
Okay, Cian, Tracy, thank you so much for that. Enjoy the rest of your mammoth trip. I'm sure we'll be talking to you again over the next few weeks. And as you said, all going to plan, you'll be there. You'll be home for Christmas.
Fingers crossed. Thank you.
Thanks, Cian. Talk to you soon. Right, we're going to take a very quick break. Do stay with us. Damien Lawler will be up to speak about all of the Gaelic Games news. But before I do head for the break, just a quick score update. 35 minutes gone in those early Champions League games. Real Madrid 0, Union Berlin 0, and FC Copenhagen have taken a 1-0 lead over Galatasaray.
Game on. GAA.
Now, welcome back. I'm delighted to say that we are joined on the line by RTE Sports' Damien Lawler to talk all of the Gaelic Games news, and there is plenty of it. How are you, Damien?
Good, Marie. Way too busy.
Yeah, for, you know what I mean? For September, when everybody's supposed to be having a bit of downtime, there is a lot of moving and shuffling going on in the background of GA teams. We'll get to Mickey Hart in just a minute, because we did discuss it quite extensively yesterday. But there was more news today, and this was in the hurling front. So Henry Shefflin has added Eamon O'Shea to his backroom team for next season, which is quite a significant appointment, Damien.
Yeah, so it's still in the pipeline, Marie. Like, nobody's come out and confirmed that yet, but it definitely Eamon is in the frame to join Galway. And, you know, Eamon is a long-time resident in Galway. He's from my own club in Kilowan McDonald's, Marie, and would have been a serious servant there, would have won an All-Ireland senior club title with McDonald's as a wing forward, would have hurled underage for Tipperary, would have been brilliant, would have hurled senior for Tipperary, would have hurled senior for Dublin as well. Is a professor of economics at University of Galway, has been living in Salt Hill for a couple of decades now, anyway, Marie, and would have been heavily involved with Salt Hill, Knockmacara. His son, Donald, broke onto the Galway senior squad two seasons ago, was voted Electric Ireland Minor Hurler of the Year just a few years ago as well. So I think not a year goes by, hardly, when Eamon is that linked with some county. I'd say he's turned down a good few positions up to this stage, but the word is, anyway, he's definitely in the frame to link up with Galway this time around. And I think it'll add, if he does go in, Marie, it'll add serious coaching now to Henry Shefflin's setup. I suppose the question you could ask is, what is Eamon renowned for? He's renowned for holistic coaching. He's definitely transformed the careers of Lara Corbett and Seamus Callaghan while he was coach at Tipperary. He managed Tipperary himself, brought them to the 2014 All-Ireland Final, but would have had a success as a coach in 2010 and 19. Highly regarded. I suppose the question would now be asked, what will he bring the way hurling's gone at the moment, with the way the structures are set up, with the way the game is played, and with his tendency and his ability to find space? So that's going to be a huge, hugely interesting thing if he does go in, Marie, but certainly a very significant potential development anyway.
Yeah, big time. And as you said there, he is renowned as being a really specialist hurling coach, and so many teams are crying out for people like that as well. And you know, you did say that he has that kind of holistic approach to his coaching methods. But just from a practical point of view, you have someone like Henry Shefflin in there already. So what way will that work, do you think, if he does go in there?
Well, it's that's a really good question, though. And the thing about it is, Eamon was maybe put in charge of a Galway development squad last year. He brought Tommy Dunn up to coach, so he's dabbled his toes in the mix. I'd say it's no coincidence that most of the players, bar Noel McGrath, that he's coached, have moved on from Tipperary. Seamus Callaghan would have gone maybe last week and made special reference to Eamon in his farewell speech. So that's significant enough too, Marie. Like, Eamon would find it very hard to come up with any county against those guys that he has coached and that he's involved with. But, like, I've driven past GAA grounds in Tipperary, and he's been out there in the field one-on-one with players. not even a hurl or a cone or anything like that, just walking up and down the field. And his ability to get inside people's head. I helped Lara Corbett write his book a good few years ago. The book is called All In My Head. And Lara speaks at length about what Eamon did. And Eamon used to go up the Turles like in the morning time, and he'd go swimming with Larry. And Larry probably thought like that they were just getting swimming lessons or doing swimming. But in fact, Eamon was just, you know, kind of like reading Larry's mind. And you know yourself what happened with Larry then with the goal scoring spree he went on. Mm-hmm. He completely transformed Lara's career in terms of finding space. He used to keep saying, make the runs, make the runs. I don't care if you miss. I'd be angry if you don't make the run. Mm-hmm. And I don't care if it goes wide, but you must keep making the run. And, you know, all the goals that he got, like, were runs into space. The key point here is the man has absolutely no ego. He's one of the leading experts in his field in terms of the economics and the economics for the elderly industry in Europe. He's a keynote speaker. He's written several publications, several papers. He's in demand all over the continent for his abilities as a professor. The man has absolutely no ego. He has no ego whatsoever. Like he's just as happy to be a water boy for Tipperary Hurley, as he proves. You know, I think the players get great comfort from just seeing him on the sidelines. So, you know, he's got great coaches there already in Galway. Like you've got Richie O'Neill and Shefflin there, and there's a good few more as well. But I think Eamon's the guy who will blend in anywhere. And he might just say, for example, take the forwards, or he might just maybe look at space creation or how they could break down the inside forwards to greater effect. But whatever role he has, if he does go in, there won't be any problem with a balance of power, Marie. In other backroom setups, you have a lot of coaches and there's maybe big demands for who gets what airtime on the field. Eamon's not like that at all. He doesn't believe in pre-planned drills. He doesn't believe in cones for the sake of it. He'll actually turn up at a session. He'll look at the body language of the players. He'll look at the energy levels, and in a flash, he'll dictate the session around that. And from the moment he took over, well, it's none of this any surprise to me because he's my club, but to the outside people in Tipperary, they wouldn't necessarily have heard of Eamon back then. But listening to the players talk about him year on year, it was just revelationary, really. Like, you know, just his approach to the game and his lack of ego. Lack of ego, so he'll be a massive, massive boost for whatever county he joins. And as we say, it does look to be Galway at the minute.
Few professors in backroom teams now, I must say.
Yeah, and they're all highly accomplished with everything they do as well, Marie. You know, if you look at Professor Connector, mm-hmm. and you know, like I watch him on the sideline when I'm doing the reporter job, and you know, he can get very intense on the sideline. But then, like you just. You know, the glasses go off and the academic, the beauty is he's able to translate what's in his head down onto the hurling field. And what I admire most about Limerick is their ability to come back in games when they've been tested, or they're able to reshape or restructure. And Cody's Kilkenny were able to do it as well. But yeah, maybe there's more and more sports science coming into the GEA and the inter-county setup anyway. So maybe this is a natural follow-on, you know.
Yeah, it's going to be a huge addition. He's going to be a huge addition to Galway if it does come to pass. There is a lot happening, as I mentioned at the top of our chat, with backroom teams and manager. And Mickey Hart going to Derry and confirmed as their new manager.
Were you surprised with that, Marie?
Absolutely, yeah. Like, it's one of those ones that you kind of get up off your chair to process it because it was so unexpected. But a great addition to the Ulster Championship to have him up there as well, and will add layers to what already is such a competitive province. But Damien, how do you see it all playing out?
Got a bit of a... bit of a drop myself when it happened, because as far as I was aware, he was going to Louth, you know, himself and Gavin were going to Louth club games, and you know, the process had started for next season. And you know, I would have thought Malachy O'Rourke would have been number one target for Derry simply because Mickey was in a position elsewhere. So obviously, I think it happened fairly quickly. It really did happen over the last couple of days, and I think that you know, the Louth players maybe will look back in time and they'll be glad for the experience of having him. But right now, there is a lot of disappointment over the fact that he's gone. I think the Louth County Board would have given Mickey everything he asked for in terms of developing the players. But then again, I know for a fact too, Gavin would have come down and done one-on-one sessions with players in Darver very, very regularly. I think Mickey invested everything into the under-20s as well in terms of developing players from there. So, you know, it's a massive, massive move. You know, going from a Tyrone man going to Derry as well is not widely anticipated in our association. There is a bit to that as well. However, Derry are very, very close to turning a corner and doing something historic. I don't think any of the teams are miles ahead of them. I think Mickey has shown, especially in latter years, he is open to having a more attack-minded kind of department to a team as well. He'd always argued, by the way, that they always were high scoring. He's Tyrone's side always probably had an average of 11 scorers per game. So he never got this defensive tag himself personally. But Derry are certainly in a position where they show this year how they can counter-attack and transition so quickly. Rory Gallagher got them. They would have been very defensive starting off. But in fairness, they would have evolved under him, and Kieran Mina continued on that good work this year. So they're in a great position. And I suppose they're bringing in a guy with expertise how to win in All-Ireland. So on paper, it probably does make sense. But there's a lot of variables there too, Marie. You know, like, you know, Loud won't be totally delighted with the way the process has happened, how quickly it's happened. They probably were planning for next year. There is the Tyrone-Derry rivalry. Tyrone people won't be necessarily delighted with it either, because one of their greatest servants has gone across the border. But this is modern-day GEA, and I suppose like, this stuff does happen and probably makes sense for Derry. And I think for Mickey Hart, he definitely wants to win another All-Ireland title. And a man like him does not have ambition dimming under any circumstances. So, you know, Gavin Devlin is probably rated as one of the top coaches in Ireland now. So they will transfer all their know-how to Derry for the next 3 years. And it's a good Derry team, with the exception maybe of Christy McCaig and one or two others. It's quite a young team. You know, they're very, you know, mid-rank in terms of mid-20s, you know. So I think probably on paper it does make sense.
So what are Louth going to do now then, Damien?
Oh, I think I know probably the way they like to work. They want a bit of profile there too, a profile with substance. So they might go looking at somebody from an ex-Dublin, a kind of a manager or something like that. They also have shown that they have good athletic players that started off in Division 4, but have also, a bit like Derry, found ways to compete and score too. Like they showed against Dublin, even though they got maybe cleaned in the last 40 minutes, but for 20 minutes they competed. Their next appointment is crucial. It must maintain the momentum that Mickey Hart created. So you have an option. Do you go for a cutting-edge young coach on the ground, or do you go for the tried and tested? The cutting-edge young coach, the pickings are slim, Marie. Like, I mean, you look at somebody maybe won an underage All-Ireland title with their county. Are they in line to be looked at? Do you look at somebody who stepped aside, you know, from inter-county management? Do you chase them? But, like, they're ambitious in Louth. There is no doubt about that. And they'll want to drive it on forward. But they're behind the eight ball now, Marie. They're chasing against the clock on this, because inter-county training for next year will start back soon enough. That's the bottom line, you know, another number of few weeks. And already players are on programmes and stuff like that. And I think one guy I mentioned in all this is Kieran Mina, the interim Derry manager that Mickey Hart has replaced. I was hugely impressed with my dealings with him this year. I think he I don't know what his circumstances are, you know. I mean, I think he gave 4 or 5 years to Derry, and he's a very busy man, but he's certainly a man I'd be looking at anyway in the future for another inter-county position too, Marie. So, but look, Loud have a lot going for them. They have a very good county board. They're ambitious. They're trying to get a new stadium off the ground as well. That's taking longer than expected. But they've got a young squad, and they're fit as fiddle. So it won't be a bad proposition for anybody who will take them over.
That's for sure. Okay, it is going to be an interesting few months, because there's still a lot to be decided in many counties, and with this trend of high-profile coaches going in as well, it does make it all very intriguing. Damien Lawler, thank you so much as always.
Lovely stuff, Marie. Game on.
GAA. Now, welcome back. So Italy have beaten Uruguay in that earlier Rugby World Cup game, 38-17. It was Uruguay who were leading 17-7 at halftime, but Italy very much roared back into that contest. Now, I'm delighted to say that I am joined on the line by Monaghan Town runner Anna Marie McCleary. How are you, Anna Marie?
Hello, how are you?
Thanks so much for joining us. I was told earlier today about your recent feat of completing the Barclay Marathon. I didn't know a huge amount about it, except I was told that there was a documentary that's really worth watching. I haven't got around to it, but after reading about it, I definitely will. So it's an Ulster Marathon Trail that is held, it's a race every year in Frozen Head State Park in Tennessee. And the course varies from year to year. It consists of five loops of 20 plus miles off trail course, 100 miles total, 160 kilometres, and it is limited to a 60-hour period from the start of the first loop. This sounds absolutely crazy, Anna-Marie.
Well, I'll just have to correct you there. So this is actually a sister race of that race, run by the same guy. That race is mainly for elites. Uh-huh. So that's held in April every year. This is the Barclay Fall Classic, which is a 50K over the same course as those elites will do each year. The documentary is actually about the elite race and about the fact that failure is the most common result of that race. So the guy who runs this event, he's called Lazarus Lake. He's kind of iconic in the running ultra world. And he runs his sister race for normal people like me. Fantastic. It gives us a taste of what those elites go through every April. And it's still a race where failure is the most likely result.
It's absolutely amazing in general, though, whether you're doing the elite one or this one, because it really is such a huge test. How did you find it?
I find it very tough. I do a lot of ultra running, a lot of trail running, but I find it very tough. We don't do mountains like they do in Tennessee. Frozen Head State Park is at an elevation of over 14,000 kilometres. It's savage. The heat was unbelievable. It rained halfway through the event, so the mountains turned into mudslides. They don't do trails. What they do is send you down through briars and wow. All sorts of, yeah, so it was a slip and slide for part of it. Yeah, it was very tough, and a lot of people didn't finish the event. Over 400 took part and over 230 didn't finish.
Oh, well,
so
that's
very,
amazing.
Very tough event.
Yeah, so you obviously finished it then.
I finished it, yeah, and it was an experience to say the least. Part of it, you run underneath a prison. You run up these mountains which have names like Ratjaw, Meth Lab Hill.
Okay.
Chimney Top. They're iconic. People who know about this race know about these famous hills and famous mountains, and it's in a largely unused part of the forest, so nobody, apart from this race and the big race once a year, nobody would be on these trails.
Wow, it sounds pretty mind-blowing, but the fact that you even completed it is amazing. Was it difficult to get into it?
So this one, the elite one's impossible to get in. It's a very complicated process where you write him a letter and he decides whether you're worthy or not. But this one was a lottery. So a friend of mine, Raymond, who came with me, had convinced me years ago that he'd love to see me do it. He'd love to come along. So I entered the lottery, and of course I got chosen in the lottery. So then it was a matter of just of training and turning up. There was a wait list for it, but I was lucky enough to get a place, or unlucky to spy. It depends what your take was, but I was delighted to get an opportunity to take part in such an event.
I question your choice of friends there now, I have to say. So what motivated you to do something like this?
Well, I do a lot of running. Mm. I run a lot of marathons, and I've done over 142 marathons or ultras. I've run 100 milers, and I've done most of the trails in this country. So it was kind of just a bucket list thing to try something outside my comfort zone. I knew it was one of the toughest out there. And plus the documentary that you mentioned earlier, you know, it there's a certain mystique around this race, yeah, and around this course and around that park. You're not allowed GPS, so you're not allowed to watch. You're not allowed any technology to track it or to record where you were. They give you a map the day before, but you're not allowed to publish it on Facebook or any social media. They try and create a whole mystique around it. They tell you the day before how terrible it is, how likely you are to quit, and they kind of get into your head. So I like the idea of all of that, and I was game for that. So,
and you survived to tell the tale.
I survived to tell the tale. I enjoyed it.
Oh, it sounds like just the most amazing experience. Has it whetted your appetite to do more of these? Are there more like this?
There are several. There are lots of crazy races around the world. I suppose I'll take a break from them for now. There's plenty in Ireland. You know, I have an event coming up locally in 2 weeks, and there's lots of local events. But I would definitely go again. I was very lucky. I had two great supporters with me, Raymond and Paul, who looked after me very well. And we had a holiday of a lifetime, alongside the race. Yeah. We got to see a part of America that you'd never normally go to see.
Now, obviously, I don't know anything about ultramarathons, but is it a case that you could progress at some stage to the one that was in the documentary that I was talking about earlier? Or is this now you...
The winners of that race, the winning female and the winning male, got automatic entry to the,
okay,
to the big event. But, like, I'm not at that level, and I don't think I ever will be. I'm a middle of the pack runner. You know, I have no illusions about my abilities. No, I was happy to get the chance to run in the park and to run this event. I don't think I'd ever be capable of running the big event, but I will watch it next year. You know, so it does be recorded sometimes, and there does be a lot of talk around the big race, and I'll definitely follow it next year with the knowledge that I know where they're running, and I know all about the pain they're going through.
Yeah, can we watch the documentary now and with the whole new set of perspective on it?
Absolutely, yes.
I'll definitely be checking it out. And just how did you end up taking up running, or was it something that you always did, Anna-Marie?
No, I never. I wasn't sporty as a kid at any stage. I suppose it was a bit of a midlife crisis. I took it up. A local man started a running club in this town about 10 years ago, and I went to the first event and liked it, and just went from there. Then I took part in my first marathon in 2014, and I've just got carried away with it since then. I love it for the social aspect. Yeah. I've made fantastic friends. We've gone on amazing adventures, and I just love the whole social end of it. I love the challenge as well, you know, and there's nothing better than coming home wrecked from a tough event. I really enjoy the tougher events now.
The Monaghan Town Running Club must have been so proud of you in this.
Yeah, well, they're definitely a brilliant support to me. Like, I'm a very proud Monaghan Town runner. I've got fantastic friends in the club. Actually, my friends today, the girls that I run with in the early mornings, sent into my workplace today all the food I need to eat for the next couple of days because they knew I was suffering from jet lag. And that's the kind of people that I run with, fantastic people who are, like, such a fantastic support, are always on my side. And I'm very lucky, very lucky.
Well, you're a great advertisement for just getting out, joining a running club, and seeing where it takes you. What a great story, and looking forward to following your next adventure as well and see where you end up, because you definitely seem like someone who's going to take risks and go on and do crazy things, Anne-Marie.
Well, hopefully, yeah. I don't intend to stop here. It's a great way to see the world, yes. Thanks
Absolutely.
Very much.
Thanks so much. Talk to you again soon. Bye-bye. We're going to return our attention now to the Champions League. The big game, of course, tonight is Manchester United and Bayern Munich. And Paul Carr is with me in studio. And Paul, you have some team news.
I do indeed. Manchester United have made one change from the weekend, and that sees young Pellestri come in for Scott McTominay. So that looks like Onana in goals, Dalot, Lindelof, Martinez, Reguilon, Casemiro, Eriksen, Fernandez, Pellestri, Hoyland and Rashford. He hasn't yet, to be honest with you, Marie, he hasn't got too many other options, particularly when you look at the bench, to change it up too much. And that back four just screams worrying times ahead tonight, particularly when you see Bayern and all the options they have going forward, particularly with Harry Kane leading the line. it could be a long night.
Yeah, we had Alan Cawley and Mark Langdon on last night, and they did suggest something quite similar. Said there could be a lot of goals scored.
But do you know what, with Manchester United, and particularly in the last number of years, when their backs have been up against the wall, is sometimes when they produce the result. And maybe tonight, if they sit in against Bayern Munich, it might suit them a bit more. If they go and they try to press like they tried to against Brighton on the weekend, I would fully be in line with, I think they could get peppered tonight. But
maybe what happened at Brighton against Brighton is going to be the best thing that happened to them, because they might watch those social media videos and be a little bit embarrassed by their lack of pressing.
Yeah, I still think they'll be beaten, but I'm not sure. It'll be a rampage anyway.
So Arsenal also in action tonight, playing PSV Eindhoven. I don't have any team news for that, but given their form so far in the Premier League, do you think they're going to be able to do something in the Champions League?
I don't know, Marie. I'm not sure they've got enough kind of Champions League experience throughout the squad, and maybe that might kind of hinder them when they start to get into the latter stages. I think, you know, particularly when you look across the Champions League this year, I think it's difficult to look past Man City. In previous years, when we've looked at English teams who've been involved, there's typically been four teams that you could tip to go to the semi-finals. I think this year you're probably looking at Man City and Arsenal, but Arsenal should get out of the group. I do have team news here. David Raya starts in goals again.
Oh, what do you think that's about?
I think he's favouring Raya. I think he wants somebody who's better with the ball at his feet, and I think in David Raya, he seems to have more confidence than Ramsdale, which it's a big decision, isn't
yeah.
it? Like, Ramsdale's done really well for Arsenal over the last 18 months in particular. Some of the saves he's pulled off kept them in games and got them points.
And Arteta hasn't really put he hasn't put a foot wrong too many occasions either.
No, he hasn't. And people were saying on the weekend that Raya was coming in for the Everton game, with maybe Ramsdale coming back in mm-hmm. for the Champions League. This looks like Raya's come in and is number one right now. But they look like Raya, White, Gabriel Saliba, Zinchenko, Odegaard, Rice, Havertz, Saka, Jesus and Trossard. So a couple of changes there from the weekend. I think they should be more than okay, Marie, to get out of their group. Their group isn't one of the more challenging ones, and when they get into the knockout stages, maybe that lack of experience might be something that holds them back.
49 minutes gone now, 50 minutes gone in the Real Madrid Union Berlin game. Still no goals there from either, but you'd expect one to come from Real Madrid soon, Paul?
Yeah, you would. They've been knocking on the door. They just seem to be lacking that sort of killer instinct in the final end of the pitch. Really miss Vinicius Junior. Hasselu doesn't give you a huge amount in games like this, when a team is playing with a low block and you've got somebody like Benucci from ex-Juventus playing for Union Berlin with so much experience, kind of keeping him at bay. But yeah, you would expect Real Madrid will come good. Another one where you look at the group and it's not the most difficult. You expect Real Madrid and Napoli to get out of that with relative ease. But yeah, Real Madrid a bit of an unknown quantity, Marie. Not really sure what to make of the team and whether or not they can go deep in this competition like they have done in previous years. But you would expect that they would get over the line. Hopefully it's as dramatic as Lazio last night, with the keeper popping up with a header in the last minute.
We saw some of the big teams in action last night, including Manchester City, Barcelona, AC Milan, PSG, Borussia Dortmund, Newcastle, if you would call them a big team, Atletico Madrid. Did anybody stand out for you? Man City aside, really.
I genuinely think, I know you said Man City is out, I think Man City are going to have that spell that Real Madrid had a couple of years ago. I think when you look at the age profile of the squad, just how many tools they have, Pep Guardiola, I think they could go on and win, you know, 3-4 or 4-5. I don't think the levels of the other teams are there, you know, compared to maybe years gone by. PSG's results stood out. You know, Enrique gone in there, there's obviously been a lot of change with Neymar and Messi going out the door. Big win for them. And outside of that, Barcelona, you would expect them to beat Antwerp. Joao Felix was on fire. They look really good going forward, but I'm still a bit shaky at the back. A good point for Newcastle. You know, they were lucky probably to get out with a point, but I'm sure Eddie Howe will be absolutely delighted. It's a really tough group. Going to be a hard one. I don't see them getting out of it, to be honest with you. I think AC Milan and Dortmund might pip them to that, with PSG topping the group. But a good point and something to build on.
Okay, Paul Curry, thank you so much for coming in. That is all we have time for this evening. Beto da Silva is up next. RTE 2FM.